listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. I'm Michael Sterling.
And I am Paul Strolley.
And you're listening to State of the Arts.
As always, presented to you by Breakdown Services. Delighted to have them as a presenting sponsor. And a very exciting show today, and easily, collectively, the tallest guests we have had in the history of our show. It's a big and tall
big and tall show
of State of the Arts.
If it's not big and tall on Mondays, it's no pants Mondays.
Oh, is that the other thing? Well, let's not combine the two for today.
No, actually,
that was on, I read that on Chris Meehan, a great comic that I know, had a bit on his Facebook page, and he said, I'm from San Francisco, and we have so many transsexuals in San Francisco that Victoria's Secret just opened a big and tall, which I thought was actually fair.
Well, before we move on, I'd just like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com as one of our sponsors. And it is the Internet's most prominent listing for sources, listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're very grateful to them for lending their support to our weekly live arts calendar, which will be done later in the show.
And for those of you who don't know, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit www.breakdownexpress.com.
Good people they are.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. So, Michael, how was your before? Well, first, let's tell folks who we have here with us today.
Yes, indeed. We have with us the stars of Edmund White's Terre Haute, currently enjoying its Los Angeles premiere at the Blank Theater Company in Los Angeles, and it stars Mike Farrell and Mr. Jim Perrick, and they'll be coming up in just a few minutes.
Who have both joined us, and the Blank Theater is a great, great theater.
Fantastic.
I know our friend Warren Davis, who I believe is doing sound for this production, very active in their Young Playwrights Festival, which is just a wonderful, wonderful resource for young actors, writers, and performers in Los Angeles, and there's not enough of that, so
you
we're very grateful
got that
to see
right.
you.
So how was your week, Paul?
My week was fine. I hear that you had another, clothing.
Another sighting.
Another wardrobe malfunction. You just...
You're going to make me talk about that?
Oh, no, not the wardrobe malfunction. The thing that dressed at your club.
Someone came
into your club and...
You know, I was telling Mike Farrell here before we started the show that I have a nightclub, Jim. I have a nightclub in town that is called Sterling's Upstairs at Vitello's, which is a very famous restaurant. In the Tujunga Village.
What was that name again, Michael?
Sterling's Upstairs at Vitello's.
Oh, Vitello's in lovely Studio City.
Studio City, yeah. Doesn't get any prettier than that.
Can you tell I get a kickback? Does it show?
And we've been there 4 years. And I produce the best of Broadway performers in concert and nightclub artists in concert. And our crowd is fairly upscale, you know. And they come dressed. People get dressed. It's a supper club. You know, you come there for dinner and you come there for a great show. Mm-hmm. And it's a lovely evening. You feel like you're back in New York in the Broadway district. And perhaps upstairs at Sardi's. Many people compare us to that. And early on in the first year, there used to be a late-night comedy show that followed my shows. And this one particular evening, it was full of you know, my people were still there, and after the show, it's a big schmooze with the headliner, and the audience gets to greet them and meet them and their friends who are in the audience, etc. And I turn around out of my peripheral vision, coming through the front door, is a very tall man, not unlike you two gentlemen, very tall, perhaps even taller than you, actually. Cowboy hat, skin-tight T-shirt, Western, you know, belt with the big belt buckle, skin-tight jeans, cowboy boots. And I knew that he was not in the right place just by, you know, first of all, it was the end of the evening, came in and said to me, howdy, is this where the comedy club is? And I said, no, I'm so sorry, it's not. It's going to be in about 45 minutes. So I said, but we're just getting through here with our Broadway stars that have been in concert here for the last 2 hours. Oh, I'm sorry, you know, he says. And all of my customers turn around and look at this guy, primarily because of the T-shirt. And it said on the T-shirt, vaginas are cool.
See, yeah. Now, a lot of people don't know, but that's actually a chain of strip clubs in Alaska. Well, no, just right, just that's it. Just that's vaginas it. Are vaginas cool on the t-shirt. Cool.
And while I'm sure they are, it begs the question: what's happened, to the dress codes, if that we used to have? I know we used.
Yeah, but do you ever think, Michael? Maybe it's. I mean, Mike, you've known Michael for years. I mean, was he always this persnickety? Because he's a little bit. You're. Well,
a rough word, isn't it?
Persnickety is tough. Yeah, I would say a little more formal than.
Well,
thank you, Mike.
I said persnickety because Michael, you told the story of you had a tuxedo on at 7.
There was a reason.
Well, I really shouldn't talk because I am the world's first metrosexual, as you know.
Yes.
And I was happy to see, looking through Mike's promotional material, that he's a biker as well, a motorcycle enthusiast still. And it really sort of tells me, where I am in terms of the metrosexual world, because I also ride a motorcycle, and I guarantee I'm the only biker in L.A. with a static guard and a lint remover in the saddlebags. So I was sure that I am calling the kettle black, as it were.
Paul is an Ovation-nominated actor for a show that played in Los Angeles for quite a long time.
Actually. Well, it played here for a couple of years, but then it went on
over the country, off-Broadway.
Yeah, it was called Straight Up With a Twist, and it was, the whole thing about the straight guy who's perceived as gay because of his interests, because of, the happily married guy who knows a little too much about fashion. It predates the whole metrosexual thing. Mm-hmm. And we had planned to do 8 performances, and 8 performances became 1,800 performances over 9 years.
Yeah. Wow.
So
wow.
It was a big, we had a ball with it. It was
the
a great
subtitle
time.
On the show, the original title was Renaissance Geek,
right.
And it became Straight Up With a Twist, but the subtitle was The World Is a Cruel Place when you've got good taste and a great eye for color.
Yeah. And what was so lucky about it was that here we did it. It was great. We had a good time. And it was about a year and a half, and it was waning a little bit. It was a great run for a show. And then Queer Eye for the Straight Guy hit.
Oh, right.
And then all of a sudden, anything that even remotely smelled that, they were just like, hey. And the people were like, well, does it bother you that you had the idea before Queer Eye for the Straight Guy? It's like, no, not at all.
Thank you.
Yeah, because then I got 7 more years out of it. So, but anyway, speaking of productions, I do want to jump right into Terre Haute, because I think the idea is absolutely fascinating, and I can't wait to see it. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm very anxious to see it. Could we ask Mike or Jim, whoever, if you would just kick off with the premise, because I think this is fascinating about this correspondence that Gore Vidal and Timothy McVeigh had. And could one of you just sort of give us the synopsis, or give the listeners the synopsis?
Sure. The fact is that Timothy McVeigh, when he was on death row in Terre Haute, Indiana, in prison there, wrote a letter to Gore Vidal applauding an article Vidal had written criticizing the United States government for what he called shredding the Bill of Rights, which he was very vociferous about. And Vidal wrote him back, and it began a correspondence between the two of them, which wasn't well known, but the fact is that they did have this relationship via mail. And as I understand it, McVeigh asked Vidal to come and be a witness at his execution, which Vidal had intended to do, but claims that there was some scheduling problem that made it impossible for him to be there. However, Edmund White took that premise, that idea of a relationship, and in fact crafted a fictional version of it wherein a Vidal-like character goes into the prison at Terre Haute and as a journalist and interviews the guy what they call Harrison, who is the McVeigh character. It's really quite an extraordinary, I think, a demonstration of the use of fiction and the use of theater to bring to light some really extraordinary aspects of this man and his what he did and what he how he felt, he being Timothy McVeigh,
right.
or the Harrison character that Jim plays so well. So it's really quite an extraordinary thing. Obviously there is some. It's a fiction piece, so there are a lot of, I think, leaps taken by the author. But I believe, and Jim's done a lot of research that suggests that much of what is said by the McVeigh character is what was said by Timothy McVeigh when he was interviewed and when he was allowed to speak about what he did and why he did it.
In your research, Jim, in preparing for this, are any of these letters actually accessible? Can anyone read them? How is any of the script actually based on this correspondence? Or
no, and from what I've been able to deduce, I don't know that Gore would let Edmund White anywhere near his letters. But it is pretty. At times, almost word for word, transcribed from a biography called American Terrorist.
Okay.
Which was the only time that McVeigh kind of laid out all his cards and walked through, you know, his whole life, including all the details of that particular event.
Oh, it was through that whole period with Vidal?
No. It wasn't even with Vidal. It was with a reporter named Jean Michel, I think, from somewhere up north, Buffalo, New York, or something. And he had visited Mr. McVeigh's father and gotten to know him. And then when he wanted to let the story out, he picked this guy because he trusted him to do this biography. And then MSNBC has a series of tapes called the McVeigh Tapes based on those interviews. And there are pieces of it that are almost word for word from that biography into this play, right out of the mouth of the characters.
So and it's important to understand that the Vidal-McVeigh relationship, such as it was in correspondence, is really only the springboard.
I mean, right, sure, we, sure.
Yeah. I think only Vidal knows what those letters said.
Okay. But,
I think it was an imagination exercise for the
author of the book.
But it was he had access to all this material that McVeigh had articulated, so he was able to put him, I think, himself in the position of the interlocutor.
I see. Okay. Yeah, so that's very interesting, because so much of the time when you read about things like this, it's always about getting accuracy and getting it exactly as it was. And this is fascinating, because it's really just the germ of the idea that this piece of fiction has come out of a little bit of
but again, it is very accurate in terms of McVeigh's presentation of his life and his facts.
Right.
The information about that character is correct information, with the exception of just some small things, like they got his rank wrong. He was a sergeant in the army. They call him a lieutenant in this, and things like that. But the rest of it is his story. It's his telling. It's real events from McVeigh's life. The way he described it in the biography and on these tapes, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the most important thing for me, at any rate, and it's been borne out now so far by some of the people in the audience who've responded to it, I think it's terrifically important that we recognize that people who do terrible things are still people.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's this whole notion in life that they're monsters, they're animals, they're not human beings, they are somehow disposable because they're these awful, awful creatures. And a lot of the people come away from the theater with a sense that, not that they like Timothy McVeigh or that they believe that what he did was right, but that they sense that there was a human being there, a confused, angry, frustrated human being who did what he did for from his perspective, very good reasons.
Well, what's the most fascinating part of examining anyone like that, whether it's McVeigh or anyone else who has done, you know, a truly evil thing? What's fascinating about that is what we can learn from leading up to that point.
Exactly.
What happened in that person's life that caused that decision, that got that germ in there, or whatever that idea was that sort of made him truly believe? Because that to me is the most fascinating thing about reading anything about McVeigh or seeing, is the utter conviction.
Yeah.
I mean, that he demonstrates is unnerving, to say the least. You know. So it's always.
That was what excited me about the play, because I had a very definite opinion about, you know, the feelings I had associated with just even hearing the name Timothy McVeigh.
Sure.
I thought I knew kind of what was going on. That I didn't grow up too terribly far from there, you know, in North Texas. It was a big deal when that happened.
Yeah.
And we all were told this nut, you know, this crazy nut one did this nutty thing. What a monster. And as I read the play, I realized that the guy used rationality, used reason, used weighing things out, referring to the Constitution that he believed in, waiting for a system of checks and balances to step up and say, Yeah, murderers, be whether they work for the government or not, get treated equally, and they did not. And he used what he had learned from a government against the government, and then the government put him down for it. Huh. And it piqued my curiosity and, you know, kind of inflamed my confusion about the thing to the point where I wanted to spend some time with it. And I think what Mike is saying is so true, that people are not what they do, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
People are inherently something different. They are something, and then they do things.
Right.
And it's so easy when you're on one side of the bars to blur that line. But if anybody in this room or anybody listening was what they did or thought today, at some point, we'd all be monsters, wouldn't we?
Well, and it's also easy to blur the line when you're outside it, you know, with the clarity of looking at it later, or the hindsight is 20/20. I know it's a trite thing to say, but, you know, to look at it later with the clarity and everything, you can't, you know, when you're standing on the dock, you can be very judgmental of the person flailing in the water.
That's
yeah. You know, so...
If there's anything I've learned in the work I've done in the social justice arena, it's that no one is only the worst thing he or she has ever done.
Right.
Amen.
Right. Very true.
I'm putting that on my Facebook page.
I think she'll put it up at the entrance of the club.
Next time somebody
wears...
And what club was that again, Michael? I'm sorry?
Sterling's Upstairs at Vitello's.
At Vitello's, yes.
Let me ask you, gentlemen, something. You're both... your roots are in theater. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Mike and I met in theater. Actually, we did a play together.
Yes.
Paul, you paying attention?
I am.
Yeah, we did.
Blood, I'm sorry. Sweat. I'm making a reservation at Sterling's Upstairs.
Oh, are you?
I was a little distracted. Forgive me.
Great pasta.
Blood, Sweat, and Stanley Poole.
Yes, indeed.
And Mike was the star, and I was the young private Robert Oglethorpe. Kind of second banana to you.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
We had a ball, right?
We did. We had a great time. Burbank Little Theater.
Theater.
Really?
Now he plays the Burbank Big Theater.
Yeah.
And places like The Blank. But here's my question for you. You come from theater, and then you have great success on television, as you both have had. You being from MASH, of course, Mike, and from True Blood on HBO. How did this project come about? How did it come to you? Why did you decide to do it? How often do you do theater?
Go ahead, Jim.
I do a lot of theater, but it's usually within what feels like almost a family setting at my school, Playhouse West. It's an acting school and then a repertory company, and we do plays nonstop.
Right.
And then with my buddies, too, we rent places, we'll put stuff up all the time, but I guess this came about. I had mentioned to my representation I'd like to maybe look at theater in New York and London, and nothing really came. And I was in London, and they sent the script and said, "Would you want to do a play in L.A.?" And like I said, at first I said, "I don't know," and then read it and really, really just got very curious. Went in and met with them. Did a fair amount of research and had a conversation, and midway through the conversation they said, "If you want to do this, then we'd be happy to have you." So great. And then met Mike, and off we went.
And Mike?
Well, as you know, as you suggested, Michael, when I came up in the business, doing theater, whatever kind of theater you could get a job in, was a way to do a showcase. There was a way to invite an agent, invite a casting director, and say, "Oh, you know, look, I can stand up in front of an audience and do lines and actually be funny or dramatically credible, and I don't faint." You know, you kind of have to prove that to people for a while, and. So I did a lot of theater in the area, in Laguna Beach, and
well, the first thing I saw you do, actually, on the stage was Barefoot in the Park.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, out of Glendale Center
right,
Theater.
Right, Glendale
remember
Center
that?
Theater. Oh, yeah. God, yes. Yeah, I did a number of shows there, and in Burbank, and in Hollywood, and in Laguna, and in wherever. It's South Coast Repertory, which was then in somebody's garage, and now it's a big deal down
there. Yeah.
South Coast Repertory in someone's garage. Oh, wow.
It was a fabulous...
It has to begin somewhere, right?
That's right. And then, as I, you know, got lucky, and things happened in television and in the feature area, the theater kind of took a back seat because you had to be available. But every once in a while something came up. I did a national tour of David Rintel's play on Clarence Darrow, the thing that Henry Fonda was so well known for, which was wonderful. I mean, it was a terrific opportunity to do a one-man show. And for the LA Theater Works, I did a country-wide tour with Ed Asner of the the great Tennessee Monkey Trial, the Clarence Darrow William Jennings Bryan
yes.
conflict, which is again wonderful. But this came up. They just sent it to me and said, "We'd like to know if you're interested in doing this." And I read it and I thought to myself, "No one would ever offer me this play. No one would ever think of me for this part. I'd love to do this. Are you kidding me?"
Imagine that guy was saying, "We need someone to play Gore Vidal. Is Farrell available?"
Right. First thing I asked them when I went in, they said, "You know, if you're willing, we'd love to have a meeting." And I said, "Sure." I came in and sat down. I said, "Who thought of me for this?" And they all lied. They said, "We all did." Well, I don't know who was the original person, but I said, "This is impossible that anybody ever thought of me for this." And I'm thrilled at the idea that I get to play a character, you know, because it's usually, I'll tell you a story. I've played, you know, BJ and so many wonderful characters.
Also in Providence, your character in Providence.
Right, yeah. Jim Hansen. But I was cast in an arc on Desperate Housewives, and the guy was a real son of a bitch. And Mark,
are we talking about one of the producers?
Mark Cherry called me, and he said, "Now, Mike, I want you to understand. You know, everybody knows you're really a nice guy. I want you to understand this guy is really a bastard, and I hope you don't mind that." I said, "Mark, it's called acting. I want to be able to play characters.
I want to be a bastard."
And it's juicy. A lot of the time it's juicy. I mean, especially when you mentioned the MASH character. And if ever there was just a personification of just a very kind, good family man and all that. So you have to love the opportunity to tear into some juicy bastard role.
Truly. I mean, I loved being BJ. I would not trade that for anything. But I don't want that to mean that that's the only role I ever play. You know, or somebody like BJ is the only person I ever play. I'm an actor. And when they gave me this and I read the script, I said, "Ah, God, please, yes, okay."
Now, along those same lines, Jim, when you presented with the opportunity to play someone or a character, I want to make sure we draw that distinction here that they're not playing these particular characters,
right?
But a character similar to Timothy McVeigh or styled after Timothy McVeigh. I mean. Mike mentioned earlier what the audiences are going away with, and that they're maybe seeing a little more of the depth of these characters. What were your fears? Did you have fears going into it playing someone like that? What were your concerns about playing someone like that? Or was it as simple as just viewing it because it is fiction as a character in a play that you were just going to make your own?
No, I mean, you know, I don't ever think in terms of what will people make of this, what will people think of me, what will people even think about the part. I was telling Mike last week, I'm nowhere near clever enough to figure out what everybody's going to think. But the script lays out a situation, and within the situation there's a couple people, and there's some hints at the kind of people they are. So the big thing for me is just figuring out what it is that's happening, and then, you know, you do it a little different than you would. You do it the way maybe it's suggested this other person is, but without any consideration for maybe what people wish Timothy McVeigh was like or what they hope he wasn't.
Right.
I can't interest myself with that because the other thing's a big enough task on a show.
Sure,
so,
sure.
Yeah.
No, that's very well put.
And it's just the two of us on stage for not quite an hour and a half.
Really?
It's nonstop.
Oh, just no act break
four
or anything?
Four scenes, no act breaks.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's a challenge when you get that script.
Sure.
And there's just a tremendous amount of information that has to be put out. And and there are elements to the story, without giving anything away, that are very interesting.
That was a laugh.
there's a homoerotic thesis underneath the relationship.
Okay.
And it, of course, has driven Gore Vidal wild. He hates the play for that reason. He said this doesn't represent the relationship I had with Timothy McVeigh. It was strictly political. It was strictly, you know, on correspondence. So for that reason, I keep telling people I'm not playing Gore Vidal.
Right.
But the opportunity to play this guy, whoever he is, this guy that I've created, has been just, oh man, it's like somebody opened the treasure box and you get to be the actor who digs in there and you know, pulls out all the little props and all the little goodies and all the things and says, oh, I'll try this on now.
I'm very envious of that because of that whole idea of being on stage. Michael, I don't know if this ever happened to you in your in the performance aspect of your career, but to be on stage and to know from the point that you walk out there that you're out there until it's over is just it's like it's getting thrown on the ice. It's a great thing, and it's just a great. I mean, well, we mentioned the one man show. When you just know when you walk out there that you know you're the show. You can't leave, right. And it's just it's Some people it would just break them down, but other I just get so juiced from it. I just really, you know, it just really charges you. And there's never any issue finding the energy because once you're out there for, you know, and you just that energy starts coming back at you, it just charges you. I lose energy on the downtime if I go backstage or whatever. You lose the energy then, but when you're out there, you just, you know.
Well, you know, for me, when I was acting and of course started off in the theater myself, and then had the good fortune to go on and do television, some films and whatnot, but I always kept running back to the theater because that's where for me, and I'm sure probably for you would be the same, and you is that that's where your soul gets fed, you know. I mean, the other might put money in your pocket and give you some amount of fame, certainly, but it's not the same, is it? It's not really the same.
No, the immediacy is not there. The immediacy, you know, you don't have that.
I mean, there's some wonderful things that you, if you do a film and it's a beautiful film and a great film and you look at it and it's all done and you spent 7 months of your life doing this and you see the end product, it's got to be, you know, it's the greatest thrill in the world. I can't say that I was ever in a film like that, you know, because of the kind of roles that I would do, but you know, surely you guys, you know, have had that experience, and that's pretty special. But still, the theater, there is no fooling anybody. There's no, you know, you're doing it right or you're doing it wrong.
There's no take two.
Right? Yeah. I must say, I don't know whether you know this or not, but before you arrived, I got a call from the publicist of the show, and we were just talking about your arrival, and I happened to ask if the reviews had come out, being that it just opened over the weekend. And actually, one, two have, and both are pretty spectacular.
Oh,
really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I didn't know there
were any.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
Yeah. And I said, shall we bring that up? And he said, sure. So
good.
There you go. So you have a nice little surprise to read when you're
made. What we should do is, since we don't have it handy now, what we'll do is we'll put a link to the reviews on our website, which is stateoftheartsla.com.
Yes.
Stateoftheartsla.com. And I'm pretty sure that if the reviews are favorable, there'll probably be something on the Blank Theater website about it up
one
there.
One would think.
So I'm sure you'll be able to find it there. But we'll post it there for everyone to review, definitely.
Well, before we stray too far away from what you guys were just saying and what Mike was saying about just loving that opportunity to do something a little different.
Yes.
It sure comes out when you watch it. You know, if you've been around actors for any amount of time at all, you can just kind of smell the difference between when they love what they're doing, be it the situation or the part, and when they're kind of just giving it their all. And there's something so nice about watching somebody enjoy every moment of what they're up to.
Right.
And with Mike, if you come see the show, you'll see it. He's having a ball, and it brings the best out of him.
And the best out of you.
Even if it's the worst kind of thing to have to act, if you can find enjoyment in doing it, it'll take care of itself.
Sure.
For the most part.
Yeah.
It absolutely brings the best. I mean, I've told him he's kind of my resource out there. Whatever happens depends on what I'm picking up off of him, and he's so generous in that way because there's always something happening.
That's one of my favorite things to watch. To watch good actors is obviously one thing, but to watch a good actor or two good actors pull performances out of one another is just that to me. I think it's probably because I've sat where you're sitting and I know what that interaction is like. The example that always pops into my head is Angel Heart. with Robert De Niro and Mickey Rourke. Mm-hmm. And the performance that De Niro extracts from Mickey Rourke in that movie is I think probably the best thing that Mickey Rourke had done up until that time, because you just see it. I mean, it's on the film and you see it pull it right out of him. And it's amazing to watch. So, you know, it makes me want to see Terre Haute even more.
And that's a key word too, generosity. And I remember when Mike and I did that goofy play. I mean, it wasn't so goofy, really. We had great time at the time. You know, it was a big hit. I mean, talk about great reviews. We got some pretty amazing reviews.
James Whitmore came to see us and came backstage.
Wow.
That was one of the great thrills of my life.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was. I depended a lot on what this man was giving to me, because I was like the youngest member of the cast and was supposed to be cast like that and kind of stupid and goofy and, you know, not really man enough for the army. And he was the sergeant and it was quite an experience. So generosity is also abundant in something that Paul has just directed for Sea Glass Theater.
Thank you.
Which is a very prestigious theater company here in Los Angeles, and which James Denton sits on the board.
Mm. Bob Desperate Housewives, yeah.
Yes, and this is an amazing show that's getting ready to close on October 24th. It opens September 18th, but it's done beautifully in the reviews as well. And it's a satirical parody of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath and of Mice and Men.
Yeah, it's called Of Grapes and Nuts.
Yes.
And we're so delighted. Could not have a better response to it. It's just...
It is pee in your pants funny.
Really?
That's what this is.
Really?
We talk about it on the radio during the run here, but it truly, truly is. And the acting and the generosity between this company of actors is...
I'm sorry that we're overlapping, that we can't invite you, because we would be overlapping.
But
we just have a real ball with it. And it's needed, I think, this sort of, you know... It's not mocking America. It's sort of mocking, people take themselves. It's mocking Steinbeck. So you are mocking Americana by mocking Steinbeck.
You're mocking Steinbeck.
But it's
the great American pieces.
But that's the point of it. It's like the Friars Club say, we only roast the ones we love.
Gotcha. Okay.
And it's sort it's an affectionate ribbing of Steinbeck. We wouldn't dream to. As I had said before, and someone asked me about it, it's like, you know, this is one of the great storytellers of our time.
Indeed.
And it's like, you know, which is why he's held in such esteem, that's sort of why the characters are so ripe for parody, because we know they'll be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, you can strap them in a roller coaster with no brakes and a drunk carny at the controls, and they'll be fine. We're not going to do anything to Steinbeck. So I think that's why. And interestingly enough, the people that come to see it, when we did it in 1990, I did the first production of this in Chicago, and Elaine Steinbeck came.
Oh, really?
And she was the howling.
Oh,
so
how great.
It was wonderful to experience that. So
we just did in Santa Monica Library had a Burned Books Week observation, in which they asked me to come and read it from a banned, previously banned book, and I read from Grapes of Wrath.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Steinbeck was, as we think of him, as you say, as Mr. America now.
Yeah.
His books were burned.
Oh,
when they were first.
They would have been burned for the last page of Grapes of Wrath. I mean, the thing that happens at the very end of the Grapes of Wrath, for those that aren't familiar with it, we won't go into detail about that. We'll just let people find that on their own. But But oddly enough, and this might make people read it, the last page of the Grapes of Wrath, which is truly one of the most indelible images in literature, was something that Steinbeck saw. Mm. In one of the camps that he encountered going west when he was watching the Dust Bowl, you know, migration. And that's what inspired him to write the story. So, anyway, and then you can come to the Little Victory in Burbank and watch us make fun of it.
It's a great afternoon or an evening, your choice.
But let's, before we go on and talk to these gentlemen for the remainder of the hour, let's do our live arts calendar. Michael, should we address that?
Yes, indeed.
You want me to kick it off?
Please do.
Okay, Los Angeles, California. Emmy Award-nominated actor and director Adam Arkin will host a stage reading performance of Hard Times, an original play written by youth at L.A. County Probation Camp David Gonzalez to benefit the Unusual Suspects Theater Company. Guest performers will include Hector Elizondo from Valentine's Day, Bruce Greenwood, Star Trek, Sam Yeager from Parenthood. I hope I'm getting these right. Roma Mafia from Niptuck, which is truly one of the greatest names I've ever read. Roma Mafia, boy, that's maybe it's because I'm of Italian descent. Wayne Wilderson, The Office, and Unusual Suspects Youth Alumni. The reading will take place at Mount Hollywood Church in Los Feliz on Sunday, October 17th, 2010, from 7 to 9 p.m., and proceeds from the event will support the ongoing efforts of the Unusual Suspects Theater Company, an award-winning model mentoring program that uses theater arts to reach underserved youth in the juvenile justice system, foster care, gangs, treatment centers, and violence-plagued neighborhoods. That sounds like a fantastic organization.
Fantastic. And Adam was supposed to be here with us in studio today, but he got called into – he's directing a pilot right now for something, so he got called in to make some
– Actually, Gore Vidal called and asked him not to attend. That's what
Kudos to Adam for being involved with that. That's just wonderful that this works.
That sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He's going to reschedule and be with us in the weeks to come. And if you are a resident of San Luis Obispo or nearby, Hal Holbrook's characterization of Mark Twain comes alive October 15th at the Cohan Performing Arts Center for one night only. This living, breathing American masterpiece is quite simply one of the most acclaimed and enduring performances in the history of theater. Nearly 50 years ago, a young actor took the stage in a tiny off-Broadway theater and introduced the world to a man they'd never forget. The actor was Hal Holbrook. The man was Mark Twain. The one-man Emmy and Tony Award-winning show is the celebrated Mark Twain Tonight.
And we have a theme going today because we have the phenomenal author's theme going on, not only with what we discussed with Steinbeck, but Mark Twain. And the next thing on our arts calendar, based on Kurt Vonnegut's classic novel Slaughterhouse-Five, introduces audience to Billy Pilgrim, a man who becomes unstuck in time after he is abducted by aliens. In a plot-scrambling display of virtuosity, Pilgrim is simultaneously followed through all the phases of his life, concentrating on his and Vonnegut's shattering experience as an American prisoner of war who witnesses the firebombing of Dresden. This satirical and horrifying anti-war story carries a unique poignancy and humor, presented by the Action Theater Company in Los Angeles. Don't miss it, now on stage through October 23rd. And I want to also mention that Warren Davis, who did the sound design for Terre Haute, is actually an actor in this particular production. So try to catch that one now.
And for further information about any productions and or events mentioned in today's State of the Arts Live calendar, visit us during the week at stateoftheartsla.com. We also suggest that you drop in at Performing Arts Live, where you can search for Southern California events in several different categories happening every day of the week.
Now, Michael, I wanted to ask you if you would mind interjecting a little, because we had a fantastic guest last week. Rosalind Kind was here.
Indeed.
The phenomenal singer. And you did see her at Catalina Bar and Grill Jazz Club, and I was curious if you would share your thoughts on that.
Thank you.
Because she was such a joy to have here, truly.
Are you familiar with Rosalind Kind? Do you know who that is?
I wish I was.
Rosalind Kind is the sister of Barbara Streisand.
Well, of course.
And by no means should she be compared to her sister, but, I mean, one can't help it to some extent, but I will tell you that she is, in her own right, a phenomenal singer and entertainer.
Wow.
And Catalina Bar and Grill is a great club in Hollywood. It's been around for quite a long time. It seats about 300 people, and it was totally sold out. And to watch this woman work, she was so joyful, and she is so musical. And she was sitting in your chair, actually, Mike, and we had just the best time with her. Great sense of humor. She's very self-deprecating. She's smart. She's charming. She's all of those things.
Does she have the same, you know, one doesn't make the comparison, but does she have the same type of voice, the same kind of voice?
Similar.
Really?
I think perhaps if it's possible.
If I can interject here, Michael, it's a funny story. I brought the CD home. She gave my mom was in visiting, and she gave my mom a CD after the broadcast here, and I went back and popped it in, and my wife was there, and just the songs were playing, and she walked through the room and she said, "Who's this?" And I said, "You think it's Barbara Streisand, don't you?" And she said, "Oh no, this woman's better than Barbara Streisand."
The ultimate.
So I was like, "Well, that's a good thing to hear."
Well, and that's exactly right. And Don Heckman of the Los Angeles Times also said something similar. He's like the man that you want to be reviewing your show if you're in town here, and paid her the highest compliment that there was absolutely no reason for any sort of comparison, because she is not her sister, and her sister is not her, certainly. But what Rosalind is a super sensationally talented woman that's got great style and charisma.
Wow.
And the arrangements of her music, I mean, from the simplest song to the most complex song, and something I found interesting in her concert, the very famous song from The King and I, Getting to Know You, you know, it's kind of a sweet, you know, syrupy kind of number that works well inside of the show. Outside of it, it has a hard life, but not in her show. Mm. She gave it an arrangement like you've never heard before, and it was such a departure that it suddenly, it was like hearing it for the first time and not even realizing what it was.
Isn't it great when you take something that you think is so overplayed and that you couldn't hear one more time, and then someone puts a new spin on it? It's just like
exactly.
Hearing it for the first time all over again.
So she was partially responsible for that arrangement, working with the arranger, the gentleman that did it. And her musical director was fantastic. She did the entire concert with just somebody at the piano, mm-hmm. the Yamaha Grand. Mm-hmm. And how pure can you get, you know?
I like that.
And interfacing with the audience in a lovely sort of way. And I was so proud of her. I've known her for about 10 or 12 years, and she's always been just a lovely lady who's had some very difficult times in her life with her mother, she and Barbara's mom,
sure.
Who passed away from Alzheimer's not too long ago, and Rosalind was her caretaker. So it did kind of cut into her life and career to some extent, perhaps more than it would have been otherwise, certainly, and kept her from performing, you know, what she loves to do. So she's back, and she's just as fabulous as she's always been. So if you see her in the country and you'd like to visit her website, you'll find out her tour dates. Just go to Rosalyn, that's Rosalyn, kind, KIND.com, and the tour schedule is listed there. But thank you for asking.
Oh, not at all. I want to actually go back to something that we were talking about a little earlier, because I've been chewing on it a little bit here, and I'm curious about it, because Jim was pointing out something that with creating your portrayal and your focus really is, as it should be, on the play and serving the play and honoring the play. But when in terms of the expectations of other people or viewers, I wanted to go back to you, Mike, because if you'll indulge my fascination with pop culture for a minute and the time that you were on MASH. Mm. How do you, in looking back in the history of television, there's all these different, not a lot of times, but times where people have had to step in to performing in what is already just an incredibly successful entity. I think of Kirstie Alley coming in on Cheers and replacing Shelley Long. I think of actually Woody Harrelson also on Cheers coming in and replacing the coach. Now, when you came aboard, because you didn't really replace Wayne Rogers, you were just a different character, right. You know. I'm just fascinated about what that's like for the new guy on such a grand scale. When you, the eyes of the world are on you when you step into a show like that. I mean, how much do you think about it? Can you, is it possible to not think about it?
No, it's not.
No.
I was in a peculiar situation in that I was doing a television series when MASH were on the air, and with Tony Quinn, which is a whole other story. I stumbled on the show one time. I was walking by a television set, and I saw this character doing this thing, and it stopped, and it was Gary Berghoff's Radar, portraying this, you know, this sweet, innocent kid trying to make sense out of the chaos of the war. And I was just dumbstruck by it, and I thought, what a wonderful thing that people are doing in television, you know, making this statement about this huge human question through an entertainment. And so I became a big fan of the show. And the show I was doing with Tony was canceled, and I was then under contract to Universal for 3 years after that. And just, I'm telling you more than you asked, but...
Oh, no, please.
I was under contract. They were trying to find something for me to do. I did a couple of movies and some pilots and some different things, and always with this ear about what was going on in the other over at Fox. And a guy sent me a script. A producer sent me a script. He said, "I want you to play the lead in my television series." And I thought, "Well, gee, that's pretty flattering." And he sent me this script, and it was just stupid. You know, it was one of those
joke shows.
Yeah.
Don't lose us in the jargon.
No, right. Yeah. One of those joke shows. It's about nothing but the jokes on how many jokes on the page and all that stuff. And I went back to him. I said, thank you very much, but I'm not interested. And he said, he was stunned. You're turning down a television series? And I said, yeah, I guess I am. And he said, why? And I didn't want to say, your script is stupid. So I said, well, you know, it's not MASH. Hmm. And what I meant was, it's not about anything. MASH is this example of what's possible in television, and you want to do this dumbass thing. And so I just said, it just came out of my mouth. And a year later, I got a call from my agent who said, Wayne Rogers is leaving the show, and they want to know if you'll come over and talk to them about coming in. And I said, are you kidding? The question is, can I? I'm under contract at Universal. Yeah. He said, go. We'll figure that out later. And pursuant to your question, the first thing I said when I sat down is, I won't play Trapper John. Wow. And they said, no, you're right. We wouldn't want you to play Trapper John. We would want a new character, take advantage of the fact that in the military, a new guy comes in and right. people go out. And then they said, you know, all we know is we don't know yet if Wayne Rogers is going to be, if we're going to be able to resolve the contract problem. He may come back, in which case this is all moot. And I said, I get it. But they said, if he doesn't, the character's name is B.J. Honeycutt. He's married, so he wouldn't be a womanizer like Trapper and Hawkeye. And he's going to have a child. How do you feel about that? And I said, how do I feel about playing a character in your show who models fidelity? Are you kidding? So long and the short of it was, I got the job. And the next thing was, oh my God, I got the job. What do I do now? I'm going to go into this company that has been like a scarf. It's all knitted together so well. They've all loved each other. They've played together. They're going to hate me for stepping in to take the place of this guy that's been their one of their chief heroes. And so I was terribly fearful of that. They put that to rest immediately when I went on set. They stuck their hand out. They hugged me. They said, welcome. It was just fabulous. And the next question was, what if the show sinks in its fourth season? I'm going to wear it around my neck for the rest of my life. And so that was the thing that kept me. Is the audience going to buy this? Was the big question. And, you know, we just got in, did the work we did, and the answer came when the show went on the air and the ratings went up.
And then you ended on your collective time on that show was eight years.
8 years.
Yeah. So actually four times longer than Wayne Rogers was. Yeah. That's astounding.
And that could have been me, because they had originally, took the job, but they had asked me, I turned it down.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah. They told me
oddly enough, I was supposed to replace Shelley Long.
Oh.
Yeah, but I didn't have the legs for it.
Yeah. And you still don't.
I still don't.
Ladies and gentlemen, to see these two fine actors in a wonderful, wonderful show that's at the Blank Theater Company, Terre Haute, it is running currently, and it runs through November 14th. The Blank's second stage theater is located at 6500 Santa Monica Boulevard at Wilcox in Hollywood. Secured valet parking is available to you as well, and tickets are now on sale. They may be purchased by calling 323-661-9827 or online at theblank.com.
And also, let's remind folks, too, if they tuned in a little later, that they're, from what we're told, there's a couple of reviews out there that I'm sure they can find via Google that have both been favorable and majorly favorable. So that is good to hear. Before we wrap it up, we only have a couple of minutes.
We would like to ask
either one of you, whoever would like to chime in. One of the baptism things about being on our show is sharing your nightmare on stage or on camera story. The more embarrassing, the better. If you have one, the more awkward, the better if you have it. Michael and I have shared more than a few, but if either one of you would like to share yours, who wants to step in? Jim, you look like you got a juicy one.
Man, I've got a few. But,
wait a minute. Didn't I see you in The Asshole?
Oh, yeah.
I have notes here about the play The Asshole.
The Asshole.
I do know. We were talking, just so the audience knows, we were talking before the show that Jim did a production with James Franco entitled The Asshole, which I just thought was truly the greatest title of any play that I've ever heard, and he was sharing that. So that's where that comes from.
Yeah. And if I could plug James, because he's just one of my best buddies, one of the great guys around, go see Howl. It's out at the Little Theaters. It's a freedom of speech. It's a freedom of expression movie where he plays Allen Ginsberg, and it examines that trial, but also just what it is to be somebody who says things, how you feel them, how you see them, and that's all right. So go check him out. It's
okay, good. Definitely will.
Free
definitely
plug.
Will.
Now I'll humiliate myself. my best buddy Scott Hayes and I, we grew up in Texas together. We're doing a play that he had written out here about a couple of jerks. Some boxing and girls and kind of craziness, and we both got very nervous on the opening night and chugged a bunch of water, and about 10 minutes into the show we realized we both had to pee and there would be no reprieve. So we looked at each other on stage and said, hey, I gotta take a piss. He said, yeah, me too. So we got up. That was a couple of rednecks pretending to be New Yorkers. We went backstage and urinated all over the back of the set and the ground, thinking, aren't we clever, and laughing. And when we came out, we had gotten some on our costumes, and it was visible, and we thought we had a little secret, and we do this sneaky thing, and as it turns out, everybody kind of could hear, A, the urine splashing on the stage, and then B, see it on our clothes when we came out. And we looked everybody straight in the face and said, that's part of the show.
What else could you say?
What else could you say?
You make a mistake, you make it big. You get it the bigger.
So then we kept it.
You kept it in?
Really?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. Every night.
Now let me ask you, was it done with special effects after, or was it always organic?
It was always organic.
Of course, yep. You're talking to a young, strapping actor here. Mike Farrell, you've got to have one for us, huh?
Yes. I had never met Gore Vidal.
Yes.
And in being offered this role, I first read it and thought the same thing everybody else did while I'm playing Gore Vidal. And then I found out Gore Vidal hates this play because it misrepresents his relationship with Timothy McVeigh. So I thought, I know some people that know Gore Vidal. We do the same kind of social justice kinds of concerns, and I would hate to have him think that I'm insulting him, so I'd sure like to figure out a way to explain to him that I know the difference, blah, blah, blah. I was at an event a couple weeks ago, just before we opened, and it was announced that Gore Vidal was there signing his books, and I thought, oh my God, because I was going to have to get up on stage and speak. I thought, I've got to find a way to speak to him and explain to him before the opportunity arises for everything to blow up on me. And there was never such an opportunity, so I had to get up and speak, and I did that. And then he was surrounded all the time. I couldn't break in. I couldn't figure out a way to get him privately. And as soon as I got down, a guy got up and he said, and Mike Farrell, ladies and gentlemen, is opening in a play here, playing Gore Vidal. And I ran up and said, no. And I ran over to Mr. Vidal and I said, I'm sorry. I really am sorry I didn't get a chance to speak to you beforehand, but I want you to know, I know you're not happy with this play. And he said, I hate it. I said, well, I'm really sorry, but I want you to know I understand I'm not playing you, and that the author really didn't mean necessarily for the author is a I mean, he just went off, and it was one of the most embarrassing moments I've ever
had. Well, I got a picture of the two of them at the event that's in our dressing room now, and he's wearing the exact outfit that our costumer had picked for Mike to wear before the incident.
Without saying, oh, that's funny.
I mean, down
amazing.
To the everything.
Absolutely.
And it says, vaginas are cool.
It says cool, but not cool.
So we should say that to see Mike Farrell not play Gore Vidal and to see Jim Parrick not play Timothy McVeigh, but see them do wonderful work nonetheless, please check out Terre Haute at the Blank Theater Company. We have to go because we're a little running over, but
gentlemen,
thank you.
Thank you for bringing
thank
some class to our little show.
Joy to have you both on, and we will see you all next week when we will be joined by Mr. Richard Chamberlain, which we're
indeed
both
we
very excited about. See you then.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.